I would call your attention to the brochure, which tells you of the talks that we're having for this fall. It also tells you that membership is $15 for a single, $25 for a family, and that's tax deductible, and we would encourage you very much to join. Our program is, if you will look at it, you'll see that the very first speaker was Major General Guy Tuzino, who came and spoke to us on Rwanda. And as you know, that's probably the single most important issue in the world today. And that just shows you how we are au courant in what we do here in the Vancouver Institute. Next week's speaker takes you back in time because it's a Ira Nadell, who's our local man about books, is now pushing his own book. And he's written a book on Leonard Cohen, and you'll get the chance to come next week to see how much his interaction with Leonard Cohen has changed Ira and Adele. Participation does make better citizens. I believe it, but I can't prove it, and neither can anyone else. That's Professor Jane Manschmidt talking about tonight's speaker and her thesis, which was called Participation and Democratic Theory, published by the Cambridge University Press in 1970. Professor Pateman's work is required reading in women's studies curriculum worldwide. Her work is widely discussed in the disciplines of political science, philosophy, and law. Tonight's speaker was born in Sussex, England. She's a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles. She's worked at the University of Sydney, Stanford University, and Princeton University. Professor Pateman is a fellow of the Australian Academy of Social Sciences and the American Academy of the Arts and Sciences. She served a 3-year term as president of the International Political Science Association, the first woman to hold that post. She's also been president of the Australasian Political Studies Association and served on the Council of the American Political Science Association. Among Professor Pateman's wide number of publications are these four books which you see here. The book, The Sexual Contact in 1988, Contract. won the Victoria Shuck Award in 1989 from the American Political Science Association as the best book on women in politics. Professor Carol Pateman's first book, Participation and Democratic Theory, was honored in its Silver Jubilee at the annual meeting of the American Political Science Association in August of 1995 at a roundtable titled Pateman's Participation in Democratic Theory 25 Years Later. Participation in Democratic Theory was reprinted for the 18th time in 1995 and has been translated into Japanese and Portuguese. Tonight, we are honored to have Professor Carol Pateman address us on the topic, Democratization, Questions for the Year 2000.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a very great honour to have been invited to present the Vancouver Institute lecture. Well, I'm sure most of your speakers must comment on what a remarkable fact it is that Vancouver is a city where on a Saturday evening we can find a huge audience like this for a lecture series. There must be very few places, if any, where that's still true. So I think that's an enormous tribute to the culture and citizens of Vancouver. And I'm pleased to say we both have had the opportunity this week to see something of the city, and we're very impressed. So it's a great pleasure to be here. Well, I wanted to say something this evening about democracy and democratization as we move towards the 21st century, because we hear a great deal about democracy today. Democracy in the sense of a certain set of institutions, constitutional government, civil and political rights, and what are called these days free and fair elections. All these institutions are more popular now than at any time in history and are being prescribed for peoples and countries around the world. And we also hear a lot about democratization, the process through which these institutions are being established. And certainly there are more countries now than ever with competitive elections, some guarantees of civil and political rights. In 1993, 107 out of 186 countries, on one count at least, had these sort of institutions and elections. And between two-thirds and three-quarters of the world's population now live in countries with a relatively democratic electoral system. And opposition parties have been legalized in 31 countries since 1990. So this is a remarkable change in a short period. But to have free and fair elections requires an electorate. To have citizens, democratization is not only a process through which the institutions are established, it's also a process through which subjects, people who are merely governed, become citizens, people who take some part in governing, who can participate. Now, we also tend to think of democratization as a transition, and a transition from authoritarian rule, from military rule, from totalitarian systems, a move towards these new institutions, these new liberties. And we tend, I think, to think of it as a process that's happening abroad. But one thing I would like us to do this evening is to think about the question for the next century of democracy at home, and do we require more democratization at home? Is democratization finished yet at home, or have we still got some way to go? So that is one important question, I think, for the next century. But there's also another more basic question, and that is, why is any of this important? Why is democratization important? Why do we hear so much about free and fair elections? What is it about it that commends itself to us as a set of institutions that we should have not only here at home, but also abroad for all countries around the world? And if we think about history, we can see there have been enormous struggles in the past to establish citizenship and the rights and liberties of citizenships, and an enormous struggle to establish universal suffrage. And we've seen in the last few years those pictures of people walking for many miles, standing in long lines for many hours to cast their very first vote. So what is it that makes that so important? Now, of course, it's a way of making an orderly change of government. And of course, that's very important because, you know, as the saying goes, ballots are always better than bullets. But is it just the orderly change of government? Because there are lots of ways of doing that that don't necessarily involve elections. And this is where I want to emphasize rights and citizenship and participation. And I think to see what's important about democracy, we need to go back to another transition, a transition a long time ago in the old world, the transition from the old world of hierarchy, tradition, and status to a new world of rights, citizenship, and democracy. And some ideas that were central to that transition 2-3 centuries ago, and how those ideas are at the center of democracy and democratization. Because round about the 17th, 18th century, there was a set of very revolutionary ideas began to become widely accepted and gain wide currency. They don't sound all that revolutionary these days because we're so used to them. But they have some extremely important implications. And that was the idea that men are born free, men are born equal, and with reason also, but particularly being born free, being born equal, or being naturally free and equal to each other. And that was a very revolutionary idea, because if you think about it, if each individual, or each man, as it's said in the original formulations, are free and equal to each other, then none of those old arguments for hierarchy, for government, for the rule of one person or group over another, none of those old arguments from custom, tradition, from certain natural attributes and so on, none of those any longer held good. And there was only one way to justify government. Because if you are born free and equal, then you are self-governing. And if you are self-governing, and none of the old justifications obtain, then there is only one way that government can be justified and legitimate, and that is to agree to it or consent to it. And hence the importance of the consent of the governed, a way of maintaining your status as self-governing individuals. No one is born to govern. You must all consent to be governed. And one of the ways in which that consent can be given is, of course, by electing the government. And if you're going to be self-governing and consent to be governed, then you need certain rights to maintain your status. Ideas about the rights of man, natural rights. Now, all these ideas were, I say, they're extremely revolutionary because they raise questions about all forms of government, and not just the one we normally think of as electing a government in the state. So agreement, consent, and to have rights. In other words, to become not mere subjects of government, but citizens who have a certain standing and who have rights, including the right to take part in government. So you have an equal political standing. And so the logical conclusion of those kinds of arguments is a democratic electoral system, a democratic government where everyone takes part and everyone has the rights and liberties that go along with that. So that, I think, helps explain some of the importance, but it also opens up another huge range of questions. Because there is the question about why have we seen these pictures of people taking so much trouble to cast their first ballot? There they are in their best clothes, they're spending all this time in these long lines. What is it about the vote? Well, of course, one thing is it's a symbol of that status or standing, the symbol that you are a self-governing citizen, someone who has an equal place and is recognized as having an equal place, someone who has rights and can exercise those rights. And so the suffrage is the symbol or emblem of all that. But of course, it's not just a symbol. It's also a political resource. A resource that's available equally to everyone. One person, one vote. And as a resource, you can use it. You can use it to do things, to help create a political system, to achieve political changes, and to help create the kind of world that you want to live in. So, in other words, it's an important weapon in the process of democratization. And I think it's because the vote is both a symbol and a resource, and it is a token of that equality of standing and the freedom and self-government of citizenship, is why democratization has been a very, very long process, much longer than we sometimes think. I think we tend to forget how recently democracy has become widely accepted as the form of political system and government that we should have around the world. Not really until after the Second World War was democracy widely accepted as an ideal. Up until that point, there were many people and many movements that were very suspicious of democracy and sometimes explicitly opposed to democracy. All kinds of fears were expressed about what would happen if people became citizens, if they exercised their rights. Fears were expressed quite routinely that democracy would lead to mob rule, to the expropriation of property. Also, fears were expressed that it would lead to the end of a proper order between the sexes and the breakdown of the family. Those fears we don't hear so much about if you learn about democracy at school or university. You might hear about the fears that were expressed about expropriation of property, class warfare, and so on. You don't hear so much about the fears that were expressed about what might happen if women got the vote, for example. I'm going to come on to that in a moment. And so this has taken a very long time. And it's only just in the last few years that almost everyone around the world has become enthusiastic about democracy, and it's become part of economic policies and part of United Nations policies and so forth in the way that is now become so familiar since 1989 and the revolutions of 1989. But right from the very beginning, although all these ideals and these arguments about self-government were expressed in universal language, natural rights, men are born free, and so on, right from the very beginning, the whole history of democracy and democratization has been a matter of exclusion as well as inclusion. Often the way that this is discussed is of a gradual expansion of the franchise and a gradual bringing in of more and more sections of the population in a nice smooth process. It took a long time, but it was a nice gradual smooth process. And that in some ways is very misleading. That picture. Because right from the beginning, the crucial question was who actually counted as someone who fell under that heading of all men are born free, or the rights of man. Who counted? Who was qualified to exercise those rights? Who was capable of participating? Who was capable of using that political resource? And it was those kinds of questions and the fears that they embodied that one of the major reasons of why it's taken so long to establish democracy, and why there is still some way to go in democratization. Because even in what we regard as the old established democracies, it's taken a great deal longer, for example, to establish universal suffrage than we're often led to believe. And of course, universal suffrage is still not global. It's a long time. The first country with universal suffrage was New Zealand in 1893. We had an election recently in South Africa in 1994 for the first time on the basis of universal suffrage. That's over 100 years. The United States is often presented or seen as the first democracy. But in practice, it's only since the 1960s and the civil rights movement that all black people, for example, could freely exercise the franchise. And even today, we still hear doubts expressed whether one half of humankind is really capable or really qualified to take part in government, to exercise all these rights in the way that the other half of humankind is held to be capable and qualified. And I want to pay particular attention to this other half of humankind tonight, namely to women. Now, it's often thought that if you pay special attention to women, then you're somehow being biased or just expressing some kind of special interest. It's often forgotten that women are indeed half the population. Well, actually, in some places, they're a little more than half, and in some places, they're a bit less than half, and I'm going to come back to that. But what is important to always keep in mind is that men still monopolize most of the authoritative positions in our societies, and also have a large share of the resources. And there are a number of illustrations of this, but I have one here for us this evening. 1994, women's share on the left in green and men's share on the right. Men are still more economically, the greater part of the economically active population, and earn the lion's share of the income. And we'll see later that is income from paid employment. That doesn't reflect the amount of work that's actually done in society. Then seats in Parliament, 90% of them still filled by men around the world, and national cabinets, where the real decisions are made, 94% filled with men. And of course, it's not very difficult to see that most other important institutions also are usually dominated by men. Now, if you take both halves of humankind into account, the actual history of democratization looks rather different than the conventional picture that is usually presented. The standard way of talking about this, if we're talking about electoral institutions and the extension of the franchise, there are certain landmarks, certain dates. And, for example, the 1789, the French Revolution, the Declaration of Rights, the Rights of Man and the Citizen. There is the 1832, the first Reform Act in Britain, which extended the franchise to members of the middle classes. And the 15th Amendment in the USA, ratified in 1870, that enfranchised the newly freed slaves. Now, that's true. They are landmarks, but what you're not usually told is that all of these are double landmarks. They all represent the extension of the franchise to men, but they also all represent the exclusion of women. Now, 1789, the rights of man and the citizen were proclaimed. A couple of years later, the French revolutionaries denied the franchise to women. 1832 was the first time in Britain that it was written into legislation that women couldn't vote. 1832, the Act referred to male persons, so this expanded electorate was confined to men. And similarly, the 15th Amendment only enfranchised the freed male slaves and not the women. So these landmarks that we're so used to are not quite what they seem. And in no country have women ever got the vote before men. In some places, they have been enfranchised at the same time, but men have always got the vote first. And it's taken an awful long struggle for women to get the vote. 1893 was the first time that women were admitted to a national electorate in New Zealand. And these are just a selection of dates to give you a sense of how long it's taken. And you can see that this is not a matter of developed and undeveloped countries or Western and non-Western countries or something of that sort. Even Switzerland, you know, one of the richest and most advanced countries in the world, it was not until 1971 that women got the federal vote. So these have been extremely long struggles. It took 60 years of campaigning in Britain and the USA from the 1860s until 1920 and 1928 to get the vote. And in Kuwait, for example, women are still disenfranchised. So there's a very different history. And we can also see, of course, now in most places, women are enfranchised, but there are other difficulties. The United States still doesn't have an Equal Rights Amendment. That was defeated in 1982. And women have a great deal of difficulty in getting elected to office and to legislatures. As we've just seen, these are overwhelmingly male-dominated. In Australia, for example, women won the right to stand for election in 1902 when they got the vote. It took until 1943 for the first woman to be elected to the National Parliament. And only in the Nordic countries at present are the proportions of women in the parliaments around 30 to 40%. They're the exception at one end. So this is a long struggle. And of course, in some of the countries of the former Eastern Europe and Soviet Union, the proportion of women in elected office has actually fallen since multi-party free elections were introduced. So this has been an enormously long struggle, and as I say, is still continuing. So that although women have the franchise, there are difficulties in them attaining the positions where They are governing as well as helping to choose those who will be making the decisions. So this is something that is often glossed over in discussions of democratization. So that's one aspect of the inclusion and exclusion. The difficulty of women being included at all levels of the political process, and the same basis as men. So that then raises some broader questions about the kinds of conditions that are required if electoral institutions, which are usually identified with democracy, what conditions are required for them to work so that everyone has a chance of being included, having a chance of being elected and so on, and not just the formal rights and liberties. What is required if everyone's standing as a citizen is to be really, really meaningful and to be worth something? What is the relationship between democratization in the sense of the institutionalization of the rights and the electoral system, and the structure of other social institutions? What are the social conditions necessary for the operation of democracy and for democratization? What kind of social structures and relationships are needed to develop the capacities required for participation, to ensure that everyone's citizenship is of equal worth to everyone else's? And especially, what kind of relationship is required between men and women? And that's the question that's not so often asked. These broader questions have been asked for a very long time. And I looked at some of aspects of that in my book on participation and democratic theory. But the questions about men and women have also been asked for a long time, but they haven't received the same attention. Even though for at least 400 years, feminist theorists and feminist political theorists have been asking these kinds of questions, and focusing in particular on the relationship between this public arena of elections and legislatures and the private world of the household, the family, and marriage. And they've, at least since the 1790s, the era of the Declaration of the Rights of Man and the Citizen, at least for 300 years, they have been looking in particular at three areas. Now, one of them is education. And this in particular has a very long history. Now, this is also something in the public arena. And this was important for a number of reasons, not least because of these long-standing arguments, which have not entirely died away in the 1990s, that women somehow naturally lack the capacities and qualities required to take part in citizenship, to exercise rights, and particularly to act in a governmental capacity. Now, as I said, there's a long history of feminist responses to those kinds of arguments. And one of the most prominent was that this was not some natural lack on the part of women. This was a matter of them being deprived of access to the education that you needed to develop the qualities and capacities required. So there's always been an enormous focus on education. Another important area that bridges the divide between public and private was economic independence. Now, citizenship has for a very long time, qualifications for citizenship, the formal qualifications, have been tied closely to economic independence. And for a long time, women and feminists have campaigned for equal access to paid work, to employment. And you can see from that first chart that men still around the world monopolize access to economic independence. And the other area closely related to that that feminists have campaigned against is the idea that women properly should be dependent upon their husbands, and that their place is not in the public world of politics or employment, but in the private world of the home. And this brings us to the third area, and that is the private world of the home and relations between husbands and wives. There is a long tradition exemplified by in Mary Wollstonecraft's book published in 1792 called A Vindication of the Rights of Woman that argues that if husbands are tyrants in the home, and of course in 1792 they had considerably more legal rights than they have today, if husbands are tyrants in the home and wives are mere subordinates, then we have no basis for equality of citizenship in the public world of politics. If we're to be self-governing, if we're to be equal, then how can two people, one of whom has powers over the other in private life, then step out into the public world as self-governing equal citizens with equal rights? How can they just change that relationship just like that when you step from one area to another? So this was a major feminist critique, at least for 200 years, of conventional approaches to democracy, including those embodied in some of the best-known works of political theory, that it may well be, as Mary Wollstonecraft agreed, that the family is the basis of the state. But unless relationships between the two adults who head that family, the husband and the wife, the mother and the father, unless the relationship between them is such that they interact as equals in the home, then that relationship is undercutting and forms no basis for the equality of citizenship, rights, and self-government in the public world of politics. And more generally, they raised the whole question of the political meaning of masculinity and femininity, what it means to be a man or a woman. Does, for example, a really masculine man treat women as his equals? And if he doesn't, then how can they suddenly become equals as citizens? If throughout the rest of their lives, women are not seen as equals, then how can they suddenly become equals as citizens, as voters, as people with rights in the political realm? And that kind of question for 200 years is the question that feminists have been posing about our political institutions and the way in which broader social institutions, including the household, interact with them, and asking this question about the conditions for democracy and democratization, and arguing that all the time in our everyday lives and in our private lives that women are not seen as men's equals, that we shall continue to see the result in those kinds of figures that we saw on that first chart, where men monopolize these institutions and women are seen as somehow not quite capable of taking their place in the public world. And that is a very important line of argument and criticism that has this very long history, but that is still not given its due in most discussions of democracy and democratization. So that's another question, another important question to think about as we move into the 21st century. The relationship between the public, the private, and the political. The relationship between our most important private notions of ourselves as men and women, and how that helps form our institutions and is played out in our public lives. Now, one aspect of that is another very important set of questions that have begun to be asked more recently. Now, we hear an awful lot about democracy and democratization. Something else that we've heard a lot about in recent years is human rights. Now, we start in the 17th, 18th centuries with natural rights. These days, we talk about human rights, the rights we all have as human beings. Well, one important area of questioning and criticism that has been pressed quite forcefully in recent years by feminist activists and critics, is looking more closely at the way in which human rights are actually implemented. And it appears that once again, what looks like a universal right that we have by virtue of being human is taken much more seriously in the case of men. And indeed, that human rights have largely been seen in terms of the often truly appalling things that happen to men at the hands of the state and government and governmental agencies, police forces, armies, and guerrilla armies, and so on. And sometimes, well, these things happen to women too, but even often they're not treated with quite the same amount of publicity and so on when women are concerned. Consider the reaction, for example, if Taliban had imprisoned all the men in Afghanistan inside their homes, had expelled all the young boys from school, and expelled all the men from workplaces, and imposed a severe dress code upon them. Now, I would suggest we would have heard a much greater outcry than has been the case when that has happened to women. Now, one important aspect of human rights that until recently has received very little attention is something that's very basic, and that is security of the person, not just from agencies of the state, but throughout all areas of social life. Because one of the difficulties that women face, and this is now receiving some recognition, is that human rights violations in the case of women often, in perhaps actually even more often, take place in private, at the hands of men in general, at the hands of male kinfolk, and are often brushed under the carpet because these are held to be part of private domestic arrangements. Now, this is now finally receiving some attention, and the whole question of violence against women was put on the agenda at the 1993 World Conference on Human Rights in Vienna. But again, this is a very slow process. And this is a matter not just of this kind of overt physical violence, but also a question of, in some areas of the world, so little value being placed upon little girls and women, and their deprivations, including lack of nutrition, lack of food, and access to medical care being so severely curtailed, that we have a situation that the well-known philosopher and economist Amartya Sen had calculated that there are over 100 million women are missing. That is to say that in the normal course of demographic events, you arrive at roughly equal balance between men and women in the population. You know, little boy babies tend to die a little more often and women tend to live a bit longer, but in the normal course of events there are roughly 50-50, half men, half women in the population. But if we look around the world, we will see that in some areas the deprivation of women and girls and the low value placed on little girls is so great that you see, if you look at the top in the developed regions, actually there are slightly more women than men, and that's largely due to the greater longevity of women. But you will see that in some areas there's a severe imbalance in the population in favour of men. There are these 100 million missing women. So if we're going to take democracy seriously, if we are going to take rights and citizenship seriously, then we have to ask questions about statistics like this and ask how women's rights and citizenships, even very such basic rights as are that lay behind those sorts of figures, rights to such basic things as nutrition and so on. Are we going to take this more seriously in the 21st century? Often discussions of democracy and human rights are not brought together, but I hope that in the future they will be brought much more closely together. Now, one aspect of this is that women tend to be poor. There are lots of poor people in the world, and women tend to be the poorest. Women make up the majority of refugees, for example. And women's contribution is not counted in the same way as men, as the contribution of men. We hear a lot about globalization and the spread of markets, and this is closely associated with democratization in a lot of discussions. And it is true that there's a very, very well-attested findings that as income levels increase and education levels increase and so on, these are associated with demands for democratization. But you can see here that women do most of the work. Women work much longer hours than men. But in the calculations of the wealth of the world, calculations of gross national product and so on, all those familiar things, and the United Nations system of national accounts, which measures all this, only work that's done for the market, work that's done outside the household is counted, whereas a lot of that work that women are doing that you see on there in some of the less developed countries is gathering firewood, is carrying water, is producing things that are absolutely essential for the survival of their families, the survival of millions of people. But that work is not counted in the official statistics of the nation's wealth, and nor is it rewarded. Most of that is unpaid. So that's another indication, another question. What counts? What is going to count as a contribution and be regarded as something that adds to your worth and standing and the respect that's given you as a citizen. Now, all these phenomena that we now summed up under the heading of globalization and development, there has been progress in reducing illiteracy, providing health care, and so on. But inequalities have been increasing over the last 20 years, both between countries of North and South, the richer and the poorer countries, and within the rich countries. For example, in 1960, the richest 20% of the world's population had 70% of global income. In 1991, that richest 20% enjoyed 85% of global income. Their share had gone up. Whereas, on the other hand, the share of the poorest 20% had actually dropped from 2.3% to 1.4%, a very minimal amount. And in 1991, 85% of the world's population were making do with 15% of the world's income. Now, if people are really poor, if they're almost destitute, then it's very easy to see them as something less than citizens. As not really being quite worthy of the standing and rights that citizens enjoy. And I think this is another very important question that we need to think about, is the question of democratization and the distribution of income and wealth. Certainly the policies that have been so popular in the last 20 years, the kinds of policies that are sometimes called structural adjustment, liberalization, privatization, and so on. These have been implemented during the 20 years that they were, whereas certainly there has been some progress, and some countries have improved their economic position greatly, but overall these disparities are growing. Now, is that a good basis for democratization? Can we really go on in that fashion into the 21st century if we're serious about democracy and democratization? There are some signs of rethinking on the part of the World Bank and even the IMF, although not so much the IMF. And one of the encouraging signs, I think, are the UN Human Development reports that have been coming out since 1990, where the emphasis is on human development and the conditions necessary for that, which includes the kinds of human development needed if people are going to be self-governing citizens and take a meaningful part in their own in controlling their own lives. Now, human rights, in principle at least, cut across the boundaries of the nation state. Democracy, when democracy is discussed, until quite recently, the boundaries of the nation state were taken for granted. But from the beginning, these ideas that I mentioned, that I'm arguing are at the heart of democracy, and notions about human rights are in principle universal. They cut across state boundaries. You enjoy human rights wherever you are, no matter which state you're in. But the peculiarity of citizenship from the beginning has been that you always had to be a citizen of a state and enjoy those rights within a state. Now, of course, a lot of the developments that are summed up under the heading of globalization are now making state borders meaningless to a considerable extent, and new transnational political units are being created, particularly, of course, the European Union. But these questions of inclusion and exclusion have been raised as not just inside states, but between states right from the outset. This whole process of democracy has been part of the making of a world divided into states, and the making of a world that was divided up between citizens and aliens. So that this is a complicated process, because at the moment we have two contradictory processes at work. On the one hand, these developments that are cutting across state borders and the prominence of human rights that cuts across state borders. But on the other hand, as we approach the year 2000, we see the resurgence of ideas of what is now called ethnic cleansing, the gathering inside borders, and the hostility towards those seen as alien, whether literally or metaphorically, and more states being created. So another of the pressing issues that we need to think about as we move into the next century is whether we can develop some forms of democratization and some new thinking about political units that are not tied so closely to the nation state. Can we create more flexible political institutions that would enable us to transcend some of the very anti-democratic and these horrible violations of rights that we are seeing at the moment? So that, I think, is one of our biggest challenges, and one of the biggest questions. It's very hard at a time of very rapid change that we are living in at the moment to know, when we're looking at these very complex matters, which aspects of it present opportunities and which aspects present dead ends and problems. What are the obstacles? What are the opportunities? How do we tell the difference at a time of very rapid change? Can we be optimistic about democracy and democratization in the 21st century? Will we do better at it in the next century than we have in this one? But certainly, one thing I'm sure about, we certainly can't talk about democratization in any genuine sense in the 21st century if we do not give equal weight to the standing and rights of both halves of humankind. Thank you.
So we are open for questions from the audience.
I'd like to ask you to relate two aspects of what you said. You ended by saying, can we develop forms of democracy not tied so closely to the nation state? I would like to hear your comments in answer to your question. But would you couple with that dealing with the relatively small proportion of people who vote, who could vote, and that's been true in the United States recently. It's been true in Canada. For instance, in the civic elections in Vancouver, we have typically had less than 40% of the electorate voting. And how important is it to raise the percent of people who vote?
Yeah, that was a two-part question there. One about other forms of democratic institutions not so closely linked to the nation state, and how is that, if it is related to declining turnout at elections, particularly the low level of voting that we've just seen in the USA. Well, I think those two things may well be connected, actually. I think one of the things that has been happening, that's very clearly been happening, is that the old established parties and institutions and leaders are losing the allegiance of their electorates. Now, this is, of course, there are complicated reasons for this, but one thing I think is very important when we're thinking about democracy and participation is that this is not something that you're born understanding and knowing how to do. You have to learn how to do it. You have to gain some education about these questions. And one way to do this is to do it in a context which is relatively familiar and which is close to home. Now that's an argument that I was making in my first book, and it's a general argument for making all our institutions and structures in our societies much more democratic, because we still have a lot of rather undemocratic institutions. Now, if we started thinking along those lines, then perhaps we might be able to construct some institutions and ways of governing ourselves that were much more flexible and overlapping, perhaps, you know, some units for some purposes, some for others, that weren't necessarily fixed within these borders, and where the national governments often seem quite remote and out of touch from the citizens' point of view. I mean, there aren't any easy answers to any of this, but I think it requires some perhaps a rather more political imagination than we often see with these things. We tend to think, well, this is the way things sort of have to be. We've done it this way for so long. But perhaps it's time for some rethinking. I mean, the 20th century has been a very unhappy century in many ways. If we're going to make the 21st century a bit better for everyone, then I think we have to start rethinking some of our ideas and our institutions, and start thinking hard about what democratization actually could mean and might mean if it was to involve everyone and not push people to the margins in the way that's happening now.
We had you were next to him.
Not right behind.
Mm-hmm. And we like to talk about equality and human rights, and we know the philosophical thinkers of the past have condemned us one way or the other. You go to Hobbes or go back and scratch around. Is legislative equality the only way we're ever going to have it because of human nature?
Yes, that was another two-part question. Definition of democratization and how will human nature defeat equality? These are big questions people are asking. Well, democratization, I was trying to draw a contrast actually in my talk between the more conventional notion of what democratization is about, and I'm not, of course, wanting to dispute this is partly what it's about, which is to develop free and fair elections, civil liberties, freedom of association, political parties, constitutional government, all those familiar kinds of things. But what I also was trying to stress that we should think about democratization in a much broader sense. Partly think about it, well, how do we make those institutions work so that they're to the benefit of everyone and that people don't become so alienated as apparently they're becoming today? And partly to ask about this connection between the public, the private, and the political, and so have a much wider conception of democratization. That was partly why I asked you to think about it at home as well as abroad. Now, human nature and equality. Well, I think my general line of thought on that is there isn't anything really fixed. That's human nature. We can't just say, well, there's this, this, and this, and that's human nature. That all of us possess the capacity to behave and conduct ourselves in a huge range of ways, some of which are very noble and some of which are very horrible. And I think that the way we design our institutions is very important. We need to try and design them so that they bring out the better part of human nature and do as much as we can to prevent people behaving in ways of which most of us would be capable if put in the wrong kind of situation. So I think it's particularly when we think about what's been happening, well, all around the world, but particularly in areas of the world that we like to pride ourselves were civilized. how can we avoid these appalling atrocities and tragedies. How could we design our institutions and educate ourselves so that we could do the utmost to take preventative measures so that we don't reach the point where those sides of human nature are allowed free play? And I don't have an easy answer to that. I don't think anyone does. But I would stress the interaction between people's attitudes and behavior and the forms and structures of institutions much more strongly than some other people who talk about human nature.
The situation that you described in public power, that the majority are men and a small number of women are elected, has really been that way throughout history. Most of the time, member in charge is occasionally here and there women rising to power, either openly or from the back room. And one can wonder whether it is really much different now. Would you be willing to admit that there is a biological factor here?
Okay, then the question is that, well, men have run things throughout history. Women have sometimes had a bit of power behind the scenes. And is there a biological basis for this? Well, I think we have to we have to be a bit clearer about history, actually. And we have to think about the change that I was talking about, this transition from the old world of hierarchy and status to the new world of citizenship and elections. Because as a matter of fact, throughout history, there are plenty of examples of women in positions of power and authority, whether as queens, abbesses, even military rulers. Men didn't necessarily always have a monopoly of power. In fact, when it was birth as status rather than all men are born free, actually high-born women had an advantage because of their status. And you can find plenty of examples of extremely educated, highly educated women in the past, women rulers, women military leaders, women who managed vast estates, abbesses who had a lot of power and so on. So it's, but I mean, of course, men had a lot of power too, but it's not true that there were no women who were educated or in positions of authority. Now, it's interesting, you see, what happens when we move to this new world of all men are born free and equal, and we elect our governments. As I pointed out to you, that history is actually rather more complicated than we're sometimes led to believe. It wasn't biology that kept women out, it was men's deliberate exclusion. Now those dates that I mentioned, the 1790s, 1832, 1867, 1870, these were men in legislatures deciding deliberately to exclude women. I don't think there's anything biological that, I mean, well, we've got plenty of examples. I mean, the Nordic countries now, there are 30 to 40% women in the legislatures. The present Swedish cabinet, for example, is 50% women. I think that's a world first. And even in countries that are very socially traditional, we've had in Southeast Asia, for example, there are lots of examples of women presidents and prime ministers. Well, one's just disappeared. Benazir Bhutto has just lost office. I mean, I don't think there's anything biological that prevents women from doing this. There's a lot of aspects of social beliefs and attitudes and social beliefs about biology and social attitudes and beliefs about masculinity, femininity, and what is proper for men and women that are very important. And also, there's a lot of examples of men deliberately excluding women and hanging on to their power. I don't think any ruling class has ever willingly given up its power. It always takes a struggle, usually a long struggle. So, of course, women take the greater share in looking after children, and women bear the next generation of citizens. But the fact that at the moment, at least, that's a fact of human existence, that women bear the next generation of citizens. As long ago as 1790, the Marquis de Condorcet, who was a champion of women's suffrage, made an argument along the lines that, this takes up some of women's time, but then men get afflicted with all kinds of things, and most men don't spend a lot of time thinking about politics. I mean, as long ago as 1790, the Marquis de Condorcet was combating those kinds of arguments about biology. So I don't think there's much historical evidence to show that it's biology rather than social structures, political stratagems and decisions, and the desire to hang on to power that's at issue here.
There's just time for the young man in the back has had his hand up for a long time. One more, then we'll come to you. Go ahead.
One of the central pillars of our democracy is the institution of the press. And for the past several years, the rise of corporate media concentration and the rise of oligarchy and the rise of oligopoly has rendered democracy meaningless. What can be done about that?
What can be done about the rise of oligopoly and monopolization of the press by a few people? Well, goodness, I mean, certainly this is a very important question. Freedom of the press and access to publications, expression of opinion, and so on. I'm not sure I know have any policy suggestions just offhand as to what we can do to do something about Rupert Murdoch, for example, who now appears to own virtually all of the world's press. But certainly, yeah, I mean, this is a very important question, and one I think the members of our audience might like to think about as yet another question for the 21st century. How can we make freedom of the press meaningful and not watch it all be gobbled up by just a few big conglomerates, which will presumably get worse as we get more satellites and stuff up there, and it all gets beamed directly into our homes by these same people? So I'll throw that question back to the floor to use your ingenuity to think up some policies on that one.
Okay, one last question right here.
Perhaps an appropriate last question, but I'm left with a feeling, an uneasy feeling of incrementalism here, in the sense that if, when you talk about democratization and the woman's role in that, admirable that we talk about the home and the equality therein, but it clearly is evolutionary, and we even have statistics that suggest that it isn't really happening as much as we'd like it to. But I suggest that there must be people in this audience, like me, come from private sector, public sector, academic, and see women leapfrogging into positions of authority and responsibility. Principally, because it's dysfunctional, and there's nobody to fill the model, so women seem to take it on. And as they take it on, they adopt a different way of doing it. So the exponential changes coming about with women involved, to me, erase this discussion about incrementalism and give me a much more positive view.
Am I being too pessimistic and incrementalist, and are women actually leaping ahead? Well, certainly there have been some, I mean, I'm not trying to say there haven't been changes, there have been some enormous changes, particularly if you look back, you know, 50 years. Things have changed tremendously. But it's, I mean, if you look at these global figures, one is struck by how far there is to go. Certainly, it's the case that there's a lot of discussion now about women's different way of doing things, or potentially a different way of doing things that women can bring to all kinds of managerial positions, decision-making positions. Actually, this is quite an old argument. Back at the end of, well, it goes back longer than that, but particularly in the late 19th, early 20th century, when women in Britain and the USA were engaged in this hard struggle for the suffrage, one of their main arguments was that women had something different to bring to the political world and to the government of our societies more generally, something different and something very valuable. And for that reason alone, let alone justice and equality and so on, women should be enfranchised and women should take part in all aspects of our social and political life on an equal footing from men. Now, certainly, women have made great strides over the last decade or so, and perhaps that might be one answer to the question of new institutions and getting people involved once again, even on the level of voting. Perhaps we should turn the whole thing over to women.
On that note, I'd like to call on Dr. Veronica Strongbow, Director of the Center for Research in Women's Studies and Gender Relations, to thank Dr. Payton.
Today, I'd like to remind us, and I'm sure no one in this room needs to be reminded, about the troubled and incomplete state of Canadian democracy, and indeed the democracy in the world at large. We have been reminded very vividly in the course of this lecture. But to open up, of course, just the newspapers or to listen to TV and radio in Vancouver, in British Columbia, and in Canada, we're reminded of the problems of extending democracy in a meaningful way. The recent comments, for example, of our mayor about the state of the homeless in this country and in the city of Vancouver, I think is an indictment, in point of fact, about the state of democracy in the coming civic election. But it is, I think, very true that meetings like this, and the Vancouver Institute is a very good example of how well Canadian democracy functions in many ways. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming here this evening to think more seriously about the issues of democracy and how we may extend these benefits in our society. And we have been very fortunate tonight to have with us one of the world's leading scholars on issues of democracy and citizenship. And she has helped us, I hope, think more critically about how we can extend those benefits to all Canadians and to people around the world. Thank you, Carol Payton.
Thank you.